which is, not quite 20 years from now. It's 17 years from now. So 17 years from now, think that planet Earth might have the ability to send astronauts to Mars. And because of the huge risk to life and the huge cost involved, what's going to be the motivation for doing that, Paul? How do you justify, let me pick a number, how do you justify $1 trillion in 2017 money to finance the operation, and maybe it's only a 30% chance of coming back without a serious health problem? How do you justify that? WS2N, K2LAW, go ahead, Paul.
Well, you have three entities involved. Well, you don't have China yet, but you have three entities. You have the European Space Agency, Russia, and the United States. And that money is split over. It's not like it's all in this year. Split over a 20-year period, you know, or from now until, I'm saying 2034. I used to say 2033, but I'm basing that on the first launch of the SLS system. The first test launch of the Space Launch System is going to occur in 2019. As of a year and a half ago, it was going to be 2018, but it's been delayed a little bit. It'll be an unmanned launch. It'll be going to the moon, eventually coming back and sending this unmanned spacecraft into the Pacific Ocean. But it'll spend a couple of weeks out by the moon, eventually come back, and they'll test everything. They're going to test the four RS-25 shuttle engines that are going to be attached to the SLS system. They're going to test that with the two boosters. Each booster is doing 3.5 million pounds of thrust. You're going to be developing over 9 million pounds of thrust. And this is only on block one. There's going to be a block two and a block 2A. Three different versions of this. Each one will be more and more powerful. As the time goes on, averaging maybe two flights per year. Some say one, but I'm saying two flights. As they really ramp up, you could get maybe 40 flights in, and that's the predicted amount of flights it would take as of a couple of years ago. NASA had this big report a couple of years ago on roughly how many flights. It was not quite 40, but you know, a little less than 40 flights to eventually get to the point where you'd be able to send somebody down to the surface and bring them back. So that's how I get it, roughly two flights a year, going up to a little less than 40 flights, and you're going to come up to 2034. That's without the help of the Russians or the European Space Agency. You get them involved, and I think I'll make 2034 next year.
Okay, let's assume now you can get two or three space agencies funding this project, and because of the sheer dollars involved of providing the consumables, a human being consumes amount of air, water, and food in 1 year that occupies the volume of your house, and it has the mass of your house. That's the consumables that flow through a human body in 1 year. So you need this huge Congo line of vehicles supplying the consumables to keep the astronauts alive, because you're not going to be growing plants on Mars. It's not going to be self-sustaining. You've got to supply all of that oxygen, air, and water, food. So the sheer cost of the three space agencies funding this Mars landing project is going to be, let me pick a number, 20% of the gross national product of the three main nations that are supporting those three space agencies. Aren't those nations going to say, that's a lot of money spent on what? What are we getting in return? Is the data going to be that much better than what you can get out of the Curiosity unmanned aircraft, unmanned craft that's crawling around Mars right now? The fact that a human being is there and making live decisions and doing the data testing a little bit faster, is that enough motivation to go through this...
Repeater, timeout.
Is that enough motivation to go through this huge amount of cost and huge amount of risk to life to doing it? The fact that you can develop the hardware, I'll give you that. You can develop the boosters and the spacecraft that look like they can do it. Until you start getting into the fine details of where is all the consumables going to come from and how do you get the habitat there that they've got to live in during the year they're on the surface. And what else are they going to do except huddle in that habitat? Because going out in the spacesuit every day is very unpleasant, as I see it. WS2N, K2RIW. Once again, Paul, how are you going to sell this?
I don't worry about the claustrophobia. You know, I mean, every day since, 2000, that's 17 years now, you've had people living on the International Space Station. The average time that they're up there is 5-6 months. Some people have spent a year up there. And it's not only that, the Mir spacecraft was up there for 15 years, and there were some people that spent over a year on that thing at a time. Just terrible conditions on the Mir. Just terrible. The International Space Station is like a resort compared to that thing. So, before that, you had the Salyut 7, Salyut 6 space stations that the Russians used to go up and do at a time. And they used to spend periods of time there, maybe a month or so. So the time is extended. We had Skylab, the longest flight was 84 days. So now we have the International Space Station. You had Scott Kelly and his counterpart from Russia who spent a year up there. So that part I'm not worried about. The food part is going to be hard, but that's why you need all these flights for the drivers.
How many Progress ships are launched per year to the International Space Station to bring up the consumables, food, oxygen, and water, and air? Yeah, oxygen, water, and food. How many launches of a cargo ship per year are required to maintain the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul.
Well, the one that just came back was yesterday. That was the Dragon cargo spaceship launched by SpaceX on a Falcon 9 rocket. Came back after a month or two on attached to the space station. That was number 12. Originally, they signed with a $2.1 billion deal with NASA to send those 12 cargo vehicles up there. So since, 2013, so, you know, roughly 4 years they've been sending those vehicles up there. Each one has carried a little bit more weight. This one carried almost 7,000 pounds up there. Came back with almost 4,000 pounds of science equipment and things like that. It's the only one that has that capability of coming back to Earth. When the Soyuz comes back, maybe they bring 100 pounds worth of stuff back, but it's really just people. Progress burns up, and that doesn't bring anything back. But their progress is probably 3 or 4 launches per year from the Russians from dropping. From the American side, we have usually two or three Dragon spacecraft that might go up, and two or three Cygnus spacecraft from Orbital ATK. They launched the Antares rocket, a combination of the Antares rocket and the Atlas rocket they've been borrowing. You might have two or three flights. Let's say I'm going to call it two flights of Cygnus, three flights of Dragon, so that's 5. 4 flights of Progress, that's 6, 7, 8. And one from Japan, the HTV. So you got 9 flights, 9 or 10 flights per year, each one averaging, say, 6,000 pounds, 60,000 pounds of stuff per year. going up to the space station to support six people. Back to this.
If we figured out the number of dollars required for those 60,000 pounds of consumable, 60,000 pounds of stuff has to be brought up per year to the International Space Station. And on a good day, you've got six cosmonauts, astronauts on board. Sometimes it's less. Pretty often, very rarely, it's more. That's a lot of cargo. And that's just for near-Earth orbit. Can you imagine shipping that much material on a supply line between here and Mars? And if anything goes wrong with that supply line, why, you've got astronauts on the surface of Mars. I can't think of any reasonable backup procedure by which they can get air, food, and water that if that supply line fails. I think it's game over. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, you're going to have, I believe you're going to have a orbiting space station in Mars orbit. It's already been developed. Pretty much know how they want to do that. Again, Lockheed is involved with that. And that's part of the, 40 launches of the SLS system. Don't forget, the SLS system will be able to bring up tremendous amount of weight. I'm talking about 6,000 pounds from a Falcon 9 rocket. A Falcon 9 rocket has liftoff power of, 2 million? It's 2.1 million pounds of thrust now. They've upgraded it just a lot less. So let's call it 2 million pounds of thrust. The SLS rocket is going to have 10,000 or 10.5 million pounds of thrust. So you're looking at, for every launch, you probably have over five times the amount of capability. They'll be putting up, instead of 6,000 pounds, they'll be putting 60,000, or I think it's 100. They broke it down. I'm trying to remember. The Mach 1 SLS is going to be 70 tons in low Earth orbit, 70 tons. And then you get to the block, one A and two, block two is going to be, it's really the third iteration of it. It will carry 140 tons of stuff to low Earth orbit. So, there you go, 140.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You're going to have a tremendous difference lift capability, and you can imagine sending, half a dozen of these things to the planet of Mars. They'll send landers down, and they'll pre-land, and pre-land habitats, they'll pre-land launch vehicles to get back up to orbit. They'll pre-land food, pre-land oxygen-making machines. They're going to be able to take the air from Mars and develop, create oxygen and hydrogen, and you'll be able to create fuel for your rocket that's going to be able to lift off and go back to Earth. I believe they could even make methane. So you might be able to make liquid methane out of the gases that are on Mars. You don't have to worry about the fuel, tremendous amount of fuel to lift off of Mars to get back to Mars orbit. They're all being worked on. I'm not saying that they're done yet. They got a long way to go, but I think they got a shot. Back to you.
We've got the International Space Station for the last decade or so continuously in orbit, 250 or so miles above the surface of the Earth. The advantage the International Space Station gives you is that continuous microgravity. There's no other way you can get microgravity other than being in orbit for any sustained length of time. And there are certain kinds of metallurgical and chemical experiments, biological experiments, that in microgravity you can do, and you can't do it any other way. Also, in theory, you can do optical telescope and radio telescope observations from orbit. So being in orbit above the atmosphere and getting microgravity, International Space Station gives you all of those. been a stepping stone to get to the surface of Mars. Why would you want to have the equivalent of the International Space Station in orbit around Mars? Other than the stepping stone effect, why go to such huge expense to put a space station in orbit around Mars? Over to you, Paul. K2LAW.
Number of reasons they want to have robots building things on a planet, be able to operate it from Mars orbit in real time. You'll be able to monitor what's going on. You'll have a way station in case there's problems. You have a rocket showing up from Earth, docking with them. Might be able to work those problems out in a larger facility before you actually send something down to the planet. When you lift off from the planet, you'll be able to dock with the space station, get your act together before you board the spacecraft that's going to take you back to Earth. So it's a good waypoint. Instead of coming in, going into orbit, knowing your infrastructure is down there, immediately, as soon as you're in orbit, next thing you know, you're decelerating, you're going through the atmosphere, you're trying to hit the exact spot, doable, but, it'll be a lot better. They'll be able to, handle things a lot better from Mars orbit, I think. Plus, they plan on sending people all the way to Mars originally, before they plan on going to the surface itself. They want to see if they can bring people all the way to orbit and then bring them back. Well, they'd like to put them in orbit and then bring them back, knowing...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
I think it's a stepping stone. And it's something called the gateway. Let me drop it. That you're going to actually see first. You're going to see it at the moon, around the moon. And you're going to see these habitat modules similar to what you're going to have going to Mars and maybe in orbit around Mars. You're going to see them originally being tested out in orbit around the moon. So that's definitely in the plan. The work that is being funded now. Back to you.
Okay. How soon will we have a space station going around Mars, the moon? And when it comes to your 34, I think it was, estimation of when we're going to have a space station around Mars, do you think there's a 50-50 chance that that's going to take place, Paul? Is that your belief right now? Just because the lift capability will be there, you think we'll follow through and be sending astronauts to a space station around Mars? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, first they're going to do the Gateway project, and that'll be around the moon. And then there's even talk of taking one of those modules, disconnect them and attaching it to a booster and sending one of those modules to Mars after it's been tested out around the moon for, say, 6 months. They know everything's good, and then, they'll just send it off to Mars. They'll do a couple of them that way, I would think. And that would be, let's see, you need to get this thing off the ground first, unmanned, and that's going to be 2019. The next flight will be 2020. Now, that flight will definitely be manned, and that's going to have a different, let's call it second stage. At the interim cryogenic propulsion unit, that's going to be the first one. That'll be on an unmanned flight. It's only one rocket for the second stage. When you have people on board, you're going to have probably four of them go to the moon eventually and orbit the moon. You're going to have a much bigger second stage, and that's going to have four of these RL-10 engines instead of the RL-1 RL 10 engines. A much more powerful launch vehicle. I think that would be 2020, and by the time they start sending these modules, that'll be probably 21, 22, 23. It's going to take at least 3 flights to get to.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It needs a propulsion module. That's going to. They need that. They need the a docking unit, which with a airlock in it, and then the module itself. So probably at least 3 or 4 flights. So it'll be in orbit 2023, 2024. You'll probably see the first people actually living in this thing. And you know, the Cygnus spacecraft that goes up to the International Space Station on a regular basis. Surprised I haven't timed out that they're planning on sending their modules there, so it's a competition between Lockheed developing these habitat modules and Orbital ATK that builds the Cygnus spacecraft. So one or the other, or maybe a combination of both, will be put into lunar orbit. So I'm going to guess probably you'll start to see, and then when they go up there, it's not going to be permanent. They're going to start off with 40-day missions, is what I read, 40-day missions. They're going to have a crew go up there and then come back. It'll be unmanned for maybe another 6 months, and then you'll see another crew go up for another 40 or 80 days. They're going to increase the time that they're spending there living on these modules, whatever food and oxygen resupply that they could do, and energy production, and who knows what else. They have long-term plans. Back to you, Dick, WS2N. And maybe somebody has a comment, I don't know. Going back and forth here. K2RIW, WS2N.
Yeah, does anybody have any further questions for Paul on the subject of space report? Let me ask that question first. It looks like we're moving in the direction of having a 10 million pound thrust capability for lifting things off the Earth into low Earth orbit. Does NASA ever, anywhere that you know of, Paul, give a rough estimation of what is the cost of the fuel that goes into a rocket that can do that? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
I don't know. I know Falcon 9. And, you know, I'd have to do the math on comparing the two, because they're really different animals. Falcon 9 runs on RP-1, that's kerosene, fine kerosene and liquid oxygen. Say that's $200,000. That's why he wants to have these things reusable. By the way, he's done it. He's two flights so far. First one up a few months ago. First reusable first stage rocket. So, the idea is to drive the cost down. And that process he came along with and said it was roughly around $200,000 in fuel for one rocket. But what it would cost NASA for one of these big rockets, I don't know. They have a tank. They had the external tank for the shuttle. This thing is really nothing but a bigger external tank. And that's going to have liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen in it. So you compare that to SpaceX is doing with their kerosene and liquid oxygen. Space shuttle rockets, those 4 RS-25 engines, those proven engines that have actually flown on the shuttle, have 3 on the shuttle, you can have 4. I'm gonna have, I don't know how many gallons of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen running them things. But that whole big external tank.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And then mounted to the side of the external tank, you're gonna have 2 solid boosters. Each solid booster has been tested by Orbital ATK out in Promontory, Utah, right? I mean, I sort of saw it on a computer. They had it it lit this thing off 3.5 million pounds of thrust, and it's all bubbling down. It's not going anywhere. And they've done two of those tests so far. They've done them in extreme cold weather, and they've duplicated it in warm weather. And they were 100% successful. So what's it going to cost for two solid boosters? Oh, no, the heat. Wonder why. Went down to a lower power. What's it going to cost for these two solid boosters to go up there? And all that liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, I have no idea. Big money, Dick.
Okay. In the very beginning, there were people who were critical of the International Space Station. Now that we've had it for a considerable number of years, have all those critics been quiet? And does everybody who does an analysis come to the conclusion that the International Space Station, we're getting our money's worth out of this stuff all over UK2RIW?
Sure, it matters who you talk to, but the Russians love it. In fact, when we plan on deorbiting this thing, right now it's supposed to go to 2024, and anything I've read, it looks like it's going to at least 2028. But whenever that time frame is up, the Russians want to take their modules and separate from the International Space Station. In fact, add maybe another module or two, and keep their, you know, they're going to have their own space station. Talk about taking the rest of the space station and eventually turning it over to private enterprise. So a lot of people want these space stations. Bigelow is still in the process of developing his, wants a big space station of his own. He's the one that sent the beam up there, the Bigelow expandable activity module is presently attached to the International Space Station, and then you blow it up and you're able to live inside that thing. He wants to build massive ones that much, much bigger than that, and then connect them together and have an airlock system and docking port. Wants to be able to send people up on a regular basis, tourists, to a floating space station. China has one up there, and they're going to have a bigger one now in a couple of years. So you might eventually someday have four different space stations flying around Earth back in there.
So when the United States is considering abandoning the International Space Station, a number of the modules up there were constructed by Russia. They want to disconnect the Russian modules from the U.S. modules and take the Russian modules and combine them with another launch and continue their equivalent of the International Space Station. Is that what I heard you say earlier, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, they made that proposal a couple of years ago, and then I read it again probably about 6 months ago. Yeah, that's what they want to do. Take their Zarya module, that's the functioning cargo block, one of the main modules, and then the Zvezda, that's where the present Russians live and eat their science. Separate that with the Rasvet module, that's another module, and they use that also as a docking module, and they use that for EVAs. Have a Poisk module, and that's where the last Russian one the other day that I saw go up and dock to. So they'll have all their docking modules and actually separated from the other part of the space station, float away. And they have some solar panels, but they would need more. And yeah, eventually, by next year, hopefully they'll send up the Nokia module. It's a multi-purpose logistics module, another big, gigantic module, probably 35 feet long. And that's supposed to be part of the space station, too. That's long been delayed, probably 10 years now. Be 11 years. So, yeah, that's their goal. Even if we want to stop, they want to keep it going. They love the space station.
W-H-4-Y-Y.
Go right ahead, Joe.
If the U.S. decides to abandon the
space station at some point in time years from now, are these modules big enough to burn up in the atmosphere, or are they too big to burn up in the atmosphere? It makes you wonder about how they're going to get rid of this stuff.
And as you answer that question, Paul, I've got a similar question. If the Russians really want to take their modules and combine them, and we're, at one time, we were thinking of abandoning the International Space Station, let it re-enter, do some steering to make sure it re-enters over the Pacific Ocean, and let it burn up, hopefully. But rather than doing that, where they have to send up more modules and join their current Soviet modules with their new modules to reconstruct the space station, why don't we just simply give them the whole darn International Space Station? When we feel like abandoning it, why don't we really abandon it and just give the whole darn thing to Russia? WS2N, K2I, WGN, Paul.
I don't think the American taxpayer is going to be happy about that. We have deals with European Space Agency, too, so they're not going to be happy about that. We have the Destiny module, we have the Unity module, we have the Tranquility module, and we have the Harmony module, we have the docking port called the Quest. Now Beam is now attached to it. That's the American side. But we also have the European Space Agency module. It's a large module. It's called the Columbia. Columbia's up there. And the Columbus module is very big. I mean, that's the one that, when they make ham radio contacts on the American side, they use that one. The European Space Agency is constantly doing experiments in there. And then another even larger module is called the Kibo, K-I-B-O, and that's 30 feet long, over 30 feet long, 14 feet diameter. That's the biggest module on the whole International Space Station. It actually consists of two modules plus an outdoor porch, and that's all of Japan's, and Japan papered it. So we say we're going to burn it up, you know, we're going to burn up the whole thing. Everybody's. So, except for the Russians, they want to bail out. So, you know, you can't take, you know, all this stuff and just turn it over to the Russians. Back to Dick.
There's something wrong here, Paul. If at the end of life, by the American standards, for the International Space Station, because it's costing us a certain number of dollars per year to maintain it, at the end of life we were saying we don't want it anymore, we're willing to abandon it and let it burn up, enter the atmosphere and burn up, instead of letting, and the American public will tolerate that, but instead of letting it burn up, we give it to the Russians, and you're thinking the public will not tolerate that. The public will tolerate letting it burn, but if we give it, they get unhappy. Somehow, if the American public really has that attitude, somehow they're missing the big picture here. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
W-H-R-L-I-S just got curious. I got to ask them, how much is this stuff worth of what the U.S. has invested in this thing so far up there? I mean, you've got to be talking about B with the billions of dollars, aren't you?
Do I have it, Dick? You sure do. Have some fun with this one.
Yeah, Joe, it's $100 billion collective. Russians, but believe me, we've probably spent, you know, 75%, 70%, I guess, probably, I have no idea, but probably, I'm going to guess 70% we've poured into it. We did all these truss sections. There's 11 truss sections. Man, it's a 240-foot solar panels, 8 of them, all on these rotating, this rotating contraption in the middle of the truss section. It rotates these massive solar panels every 90 minutes. The Russians are not going to do this. They're not going to, you know, pay. Yeah, you know, the agreement is right now with the Russians. They've been taking us up year after year now. You know, since 2011 when the last Atlantis spacecraft went up there, the shuttle. So they're paying to get us there and back safely. But, you know, we've been... They can't operate without us. We're the ones that have been doing the, that put all the solar panels up there, the truss section. That's where all the power is coming from. They say that they wouldn't be able to even handle that. So that's part of it. And not only that, you have a tremendous amount of money invested from Japan and from the European Space Agency. They're not going to give up these modules, turn them over to the Russians or anybody else. It's an international space station. It's not a U.S. space station. It's not a Russian space station. There's 20 countries, 20 countries involved with this. Back to you.
Paul, when you just talked about $100 billion, is that the total value of the space station of all of those nations, or is that just the U.S. Contribution of you, Paul?
That was the total cost a couple of years ago. I'm sure it's up a little higher now. But, yeah, that was the total cost of construction. All those modules I mentioned, plus a few I might have forgotten, all those 11 segments going from one end to the other, way longer than a football field. This is, in development, 1990s. Buy that money up all those years and figure out what it is per year. But you're going to burn up $100 billion. But the Russians did it. Mir came crashing down. They had five modules attached in, 2000. They came burning up over the Pacific Ocean. I remember seeing pictures of that. And they plan on doing the same thing with the space station when we're done with that. Unless they're going to sell parts of it to commercial operations. That's a possibility, but, I don't see anybody standing up with $100 billion to buy this thing. Back to you, Dick.
Didn't they do that with the Iridium satellites when the U.S. are going to burn those up and some private contractor or somebody come in and save the shell on that one?
I don't know about the Iridiums. They're all being replaced by the new ones that SpaceX is bringing up. They've already bought up, 20 of them. They got another 6 to go, another 10 to go at the end of this year, and a total of, 6 or 7 flights, something like that.
Aren't the Iridiums up so high that they're going to last forever? See, the trouble with the International Space Station, it's something like 230 miles up. It's in that narrow window where any lower, you hit the atmosphere too much. Any higher, the astronauts are going to be in the Van Allen belt, and you're going to cook them. So you're walking that knife edge between the Van Allen belt above you and the atmosphere below you. And as such, I'm guessing 3 or 4 times per year, the International Space Station, because of drag of the atmosphere, it has to be boosted. Whereas Iridium and GPS and the synchronous satellites, they're all up so high that they're not touching the atmosphere. So they're not going to be coming back unless we do something to do a retro burn on them. Isn't that true, Paul? Over you, Paul, KQIW.
Yeah, I thought the Iridiums were about 500 miles up or something. But I'm pretty sure it's around 500. The space station's 250. And if you look at the space station now, you have the very back of it. You have a Progress spacecraft attached right now. And they brought up supplies and they'll eventually put stuff on it to crash. They want to burn up over the Pacific Ocean with the Progress ship. Well, that thing's sitting there loaded with fuel. And before it leaves, it's going to use up a lot of fuel to boost the space station up another couple of miles. And then it just has enough fuel to deorbit itself, and the Progress ship burns up. That's what they've been doing for years now. Keep this thing going. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, 2 questions, Paul. Roughly how many boosts per year? I'm going to guess 3, 4, or 5 boosts per year are required. And second of all, the James Webb Space Telescope. I hope they've installed a docking ring on the bottom of it so they have the ability, 5 years from now, of sending up a robot repair mission. Hubble has done some fantastic work, but Hubble has needed quite a number of repair missions. You're going to want to do some repair missions on the James Webb, as I see it. So I hope there's a docking ring on the bottom of James Webb. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they did. I think I mentioned that earlier, that they did put, when we were talking to Sam, Camp. They did put a docking ring on that. So, you know, they have the capability of sending some SLS rocket, you know, powerful rocket out there. This way you have enough fuel to get yourself back. Would have that capability, but right now there's no plans, none whatsoever. So that will be, you know, second thought that comes down the road, but they have that option. The last mission to Hubble, they attached a docking ring, really for one purpose, to send an unmanned craft to the Hubble to deorbit that thing when it's time. But in the back of everybody's mind is, let's send up, you know, a spacecraft up, dock with the Hubble, and let's fix it again, you know, before it quits, running out of time. Back to you, Dick, WS2.
Yeah, we've used up our time for tonight. That was TechNet number 1668. And that was Space Report number 268. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. And I think we'll be back next week. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, clear but listening.
Very good. Ah, that's a lucky number. I grew up on 268 Street. 73, Dick. We'll be back next week.
That guy and Paul, you were just about dead on the Iridium satellite, so 483 miles up.
And I guess that gives them a life of a large number of years. Isn't that true, Rich?
I'm just Googling the altitude. I wasn't Googling a service life on them, but they're up there. I just hope the replacements will still give us the flare effect off when the sun glints off the mirrors. So if there won't be Iridium satellites, they'll change them, but I hope that still happens. That's fun to see.
Roughly how many flares have you witnessed, Rich? Go ahead.
Oh, a couple dozen, easy. I've been looking at them for a few years.
Yeah, I think I've only seen two. But one of the flares I saw was on a foggy night. The fact that the fog came along, I said, what the hell? I'll look in the right direction at the right time. And the flare was so bright, I heard it, I saw it through the fog. I wonder if you've ever done that though, Rich.
KTUPS. I haven't seen it through fog, I don't think. I've seen quite a few of them during the day. That's a lot of fun. And some of them have been incredibly bright. But it's neat to show them to people who have never seen them before. It's one thing to spot a satellite going across the sky, and when you get good, you can predict when it's going to hit the Earth's shadow and disappear, and it can kind of blow people's minds that way, too. But first time seeing an Iridium flare used to be a pretty good reaction.
Yeah, during the day, that sounds exciting. Roughly how bright was it during the day? Compare it to something I could recognize. Rich, go ahead.
That's tough trying to compare that. It was easily visible. Even if you were looking in a general direction and your eyes weren't focused on the exact spot it was going to come up, and when it came up, your eyes went to it. It was bright. I mean, maybe not as apparently as bright as it is at dusk or early morning.
12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Just about anything else that would be connected, but there's no way that someone who is not a ham could use all repeaters.
Right, correct. And what you would do, and this wasn't, again, yeah, this wasn't password protected. The GMRS group does password protect the group, so only group members can use the Zello app on that frequency. I'm calling it a frequency, but I don't think it has anything to do with frequency. Again, I don't really know exactly how it works, but, you know, they could, Limark could do a password protect if they wanted to do something like that. But I guess this is, it must be something different. I'll have to look into it a little bit more. There's a Limark something on there. I just don't know what it's connected to. I don't know if the groups have to be, I don't know if they use RF at all. I really don't know. I just know the GMRS one, if I talk on Zello, on the GMRS one, it actually does, you know, broadcast on, you know, the 462, so.
Teacher Candy, I'll take a look at it then. Certainly if it was a computer group, you know, nobody would have any, rights if nothing else to exclude anyone. But I'll look into it in terms of the way it's set up. But definitely you could not have a non-ham under any circumstances coming out through a repeater. It's not legal, you know, amongst other things. So, you know, as far as a computer group goes, that may be one thing to be able to organize people for emergency purposes. But I'll take a look at it and see if I can fill you in on any information.
Okay. Yeah, I just, I was reluctant to download it for a long time. I just couldn't really see the point in having it, but, I decided to download it, give it a shot over the weekend, and, I haven't even used it yet, other than just to test it out real quick. But, you know, I have to look into it a little bit myself, too. I'm curious as to how it works and how it links up.
Well, also, for your information, although Hurricane Jose probably is going to be just some rain and things, the one behind it, they think, could come up and hit us up here. So our general procedure is, and it comes from Suffolk County, I think, but generally the various Aries nets, whether it's in Suffolk County or Nassau County, they will open up for handling I hesitate to use the word emergency responses, but, you know, passing traffic between various groups of first responders, whether it's police, fire, communications with the Red Cross, etc. But the Limark repeater, generally, because it's fully backed up with backup power, generally becomes a go-to repeater to pass on information of interest to the general community. So that's the way ham radio responds to that kind of emergency.
Sure. All right. Yeah, do these machines do any sort of, like, emergency net control or anything like that in those situations?
We generally shut, if there's an emergency, as there was in Hurricane Sandy, the net is shut down for all casual traffic and remains in a net mode. There would be always a net control operator listening. You wouldn't be on the air necessarily. You wouldn't be speaking 24/7, but you'd be able to call the net at any time if someone would come back to you. And in the meantime, so that the emergency nets are not congested, people would come to, let's say, the Limark net, pass on their traffic while it was being monitored by Aries or by the Red Cross or someone who would link, let's say during Sandy, they were